We're delighted to welcome with us this morning the Follett High School students. Would they please stand? Good seeing you. You may be seated. And we have Tri-County High School students. Would the Tri-County students please stand? Thank you for coming. It's good seeing you too. These students are here with our Court with Class program sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court. Students around Wisconsin are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, they're sent the briefs of the case that they hear, and they do work on the case, and when they come here, they're invited to stay, and after the second oral argument this morning, meet with a justice of the court. We're very proud of the program. Thousands of students have come to the court with the program, and it has won several national awards. Now, this afternoon, after the second oral argument, Justice Bradley, who is to my immediate left, will speak with the students. Everyone is invited to come and hear the discussion about the procedures in the court, not the substance of the cases we're about to hear. So let me introduce the court to you. We'll start at my immediate left with Justice Bradley, and seated next to her is Justice David Prosser, and on the far left is Justice Louis Butler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Brooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, we will call our first case today, 03-1463-CR, State versus Trujillo. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Trujillo is Susan L. Hagopian, Assistant State Public Defender. Ms. Hagopian.
Well, we are quickly approaching the 5-year anniversary of truth and sentencing.
Seems like just yesterday. Is the microphone
on? People can disagree, I imagine, as to whether that's a cause for celebration.
Chief.
Most people.
We're not getting it on this.
Okay.
And the light isn't on either with regard to the time.
We have a slight technical problem.
But we were really interested in what you were saying.
If we could have heard it. No.
We're okay.
Let me tell the students we have a second case, State versus Stinklift, and a third case, State versus Tucker today, all of which involve interrelated issues on truth in sentencing and modifying sentences.
Hello?
Yes, it's there now. Yeah.
Oh, that's better.
Good morning. You know. Testing.
Yeah, there we go.
Light. Now we just have to worry about the lights. Get them started again. Got it. Okay, we can start again.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Hagopian, and I represent Jose Trujillo. We are quickly approaching the 5-year anniversary of truth in sentencing. Whether that's a cause for celebration, I guess people could disagree on. But I think most people would agree that the way this state transitioned to determinant sentencing left something to be desired. On December 31, 1999, truth in sentencing took effect even though the legislature had not completed its work. At that point, judges across the state had no choice but to impose sentences, determinate sentences, under the heightened penalties of TIS 1. Those penalties were misleading. In truth, the legislature did not intend longer sentences under Truth in Sentencing. So 3 years later, when the legislature completed its work on TIS, the penalties came back down. This situation is unique, the results unfortunate, so that even though one of the objectives of Truth in Sentencing was greater uniformity, we now have greater disparity among sentences, and some people sentenced under TIS 1, like Mr. Trujillo, will serve more time in prison than anyone could for the very same offense, both before TIS 1 and after TIS 1.
Now, before TIS 1, there were several changes in the criminal code. From time to time, the legislature would reset the penalties. And the prevailing case law was that a change in sentence did not merit a new factor. But what you're saying is because you feel that the legislature themselves thought that this should be lower rather than higher is a reason for a new factor now.
Right, and I believe the case you're referring to is Hegwood.
Right.
And the way I envision what the court's holding would be in this case is that it would need to overrule one case. That's a court of appeals decision in State versus Torres. It does not need to overrule Hegwood. I think that this situation here can be distinguished from what occurred in Hegwood, and in fact can be distinguished from what might be viewed as sort of the ordinary penalty change. What we have here is something extraordinary that, as far as I know, has never before happened in this state and probably will never happen again, where we have this linkage between the penalties and a creation really of a whole new sentencing scheme where the intention was that the penalties that went into effect would not go into effect without a substantial reworking and went into effect more through inadvertence than design. You know, I think I should start with what is, I think, a basic proposition, which is this court has the authority to issue the holding we're seeking. It can do something much broader. It can choose to do nothing at all. The Constitution gives this court the power to essentially regulate the circuit court's exercise of their inherent power to modify sentences. So this court really is the ultimate authority on what is fair and just in the realm of sentence modification.
Ms. Hagopian, if I could ask, and my understanding of Hegwood and Moore versus State, which preceded Hegwood, was that they dealt with an interpretation of section 990.04. I know you didn't cite that in your brief. How do you see 990.04 interacting with your argument?
All right. I think that what the court did, as you've indicated, is they relied on 990.04 as an indication of legislative intent, that the penalty change does not apply retroactively. Two responses to that. One is, I think that reasoning, frankly, is a bit off the mark. And I would ask the court that whatever holding it reaches in this case, it not confound the notion of retroactivity and new factor jurisprudence. They're different things. If the penalty applied retroactively, Mr. Trujillo would not be here. His sentence would be automatically reduced. He would be entitled to a reduction, and that is not our claim. When we go into the camp of new factor jurisprudence, it's a discretionary matter with the circuit court, even if a new factor is proven, to decide whether a sentence modification is warranted. So it's a very different, I think, analytical framework. But I think there is something useful out of Hegwood in terms of what is the role of the legislature's intent. in this Court's defining and regulating of sentence modifications, this is what I think is the appropriate role. The legislature's intent should inform the Court's decision, but cannot dictate a particular result.
What does it inform the Court decision about the gravity of the offense?
Informs the Court about the gravity of the offense, and particularly with respect to this unique situation we have here with the implementation of TIS, I think there are two aspects of the legislature's intent that help us here. One is the legislature did not intend longer sentences or longer terms of confinement under Truth in Sentencing. The second is that the legislature, when it did finally get around to completing its work on TIS, recognized the problem, recognized the disparity, and wanted it addressed. And that is why they adopted the sentence adjustment statute, at least in part, because one of the grounds for an adjustment is a change in the law. All right? And that ground clearly applies to people sentenced under TIS 1. If it doesn't apply to them, it applies to nobody, at least at this point.
Well, but you could have, that's right, at this point is the governing phrase, because in the future you can change it. So your real point is that even though the statute, 973, whatever it is, looks on first blush, and I think you have to concede, it looks at first blush not to cover TIS 1, because you have all these classifications that don't meet TIS 1. Your point is that the gravity of the offense issue in the 973 statute would indicate that even though it's not a precise fit, the legislature intended to allow gravity of the offense to be a modification.
That
you think that 973 does a 195 applies? There's a dispute between you and the defense counsel representing Tucker.
Right. Yes, we do disagree on that point, and with all respect to my colleague, I think he's wrong. I think the statute is ambiguous on its face. But when you look at the language in conjunction with the context of the statute and the history of the statute, the ambiguity erodes, and it's clear it applies to TIS 1. Three things I'd ask the Court to look at. One, the change in law ground. And keep in mind that change in law ground was adopted with the statute that was adopted as part of the TIS 2 legislation. So that context of where that change in law ground came in, it's right in the context of where they knew they had the problem. Second is the initial applicability provision that appears in Act 109, in which many provisions of that act were given an applicability date that, had they put 973.195 in there, it would have been clear. It applied only to people under TIS 2. The legislature chose not to put that statute in the applicability provision, and significantly, the legislature also made that same choice with two other modification provisions that were enacted in that same legislation, that being the modification for individuals with a terminal illness and for seeking a modification of the conditions of extended supervision, so that all of those provisions, by how the legislature handled the initial applicability provision, clearly apply to people under TIS 1 as well as to those under TIS 2. Thirdly, we have the Legislative Reference Bureau document that was prepared within 1 month of enactment of TIS 2, which plainly says that the statute applies to TIS 1. That is the same document this Court relied on in State versus Cole in attempting to ascertain legislative intent behind TIS.
Let me just ask you this. What difference does it make to your client whether this new modification statute applies? Or it doesn't? Under any conditions, you agree the Circuit Court has inherent power to modify. So what difference does it make to your client?
I think that the sentence adjustment statute is not a good enough fix of the problem here, both in terms, and here we're talking just about the disparity, in terms of administering justice and furthering the goals of sentencing. Let me explain. I think the main problem with the statute as it applies to the disparity is the delayed period for seeking an adjustment. The person will have to serve 75% or 85% of their confinement time.
So it doesn't help a lot of people who will have to spend a lot of time before they can come in there. So why are you arguing that statute? Or are you arguing that the court has inherent power to modify? Part of the modification is whether or not there's been whether the offense is as grave as the court originally thought it was, that TIS 2 says, no, it's not as grave as it originally thought it was, so you've got a new factor. Now, I can understand that argument. But are you actually arguing, so if you're arguing that the sentence adjustment statute applies, the next thing I'm going to have to ask is it exclusive? So if you don't come under that, you're out? Or is it in addition to?
I don't want a holding here that the sentence adjustment statute is exclusive. What I want the court to do is to, in its holding, to say that it's a new factor if the confinement term imposed under TIS 1 exceeds the maximum allowed for that very same offense under TIS 2, and the court did not consider the lesser penalty at the time of sentencing.
Right. And here, what the prosecutor recommended, what the PSI recommended, exceeded ultimately what TIS 2 had as the maximum offense.
Right. Well, and Mr. Trujillo, and actually he got 6 months more. 6 months more. Some individuals will have gotten much more. So the way I look at it is the legislature took a stab at addressing the problem. And that will exist and perhaps work for some, but it's not a good enough fix, partly because of this delay. Now, let's see how the delay plays out. For some people, it means those who have the greatest sentences that they may serve well past the new TIS 2 maximum before they can even file for an adjustment. We have in the brief the example of the armed burglary, 24 years past if they had received the max. Forgery, those individuals, 4.5 years past before they can even petition the court.
Counsel, I don't want to interrupt, but it seems to me you have TIS 1 and TIS 2, and just we've all followed the history, and there were some concerns about it, but this is a specifically enacted statute. We're talking about 973-195 to take care of that disparity, recognizing that two is coming on board and saying, well, this is the way you would treat, you know, they have the 75-85%, and when you argue specific crime, like the difference, one is 24 years, one is 8, but that's just the difference in those offenses. What I'm saying is that you really want two kicks at the cat. You have this, what I would say is a specifically legislative enacted provision, which is 973. And then we've always had the Rosado, the new factor, and the judges using their inherent authority and looking at it. But you want both now.
I want both. Does it seem unreasonable? I don't think it is, because as I started with, what we're talking about is an inherent power of this court to define when a lower court can modify a sentence.
My question is, well, what does that do to 973? It sort of makes it meaningless, right? In other words, you have the statute. It seems to be clear they were trying to take care of this sentencing disparity. But if you say, well, yes, we have that, and we also have what we always had, and that is the Rosado and the new factors. So you really have both. But one was under indeterminate, the other is under determinate, and the idea was to have some, as you said, disparity was a concern, and so they were trying to eliminate that. Certainly the truth part was that under indeterminate, you got 24 years, but really it only meant 8. And this way, 8 means 8. That was the so-called truth and truth in sentencing. What I am saying is that it sort of eviscerates 973-195. It would not have really any effect if the judge can say, well, I'm going to use the traditional new factor analysis, but in this case I'm going to use 973-195. I'm just saying that it does not, you're using two different types of sentencing procedures, indeterminate and the second is determinate, and that's what 973-195 was to take care of.
I don't view it at all as eviscerating it. I think it furthers the objective of the legislature to have the disparity addressed. And what I would ask the court to do is to make what is essentially a policy decision that the statute really doesn't go far enough. And if I may point out another problem I think that's created by this delay in addressing the disparity is that if we were to wait that long, in many instances, I think we can expect that the sentencing judge is no longer going to be on the bench, and that justice would be best served by having the same judge make the assessment. First of all, did I consider the penalty change at the time of sentencing? And if I didn't, do I feel that the sentence is still just?
Ms. Agopian, you're touching on something that concerns me, and I know that you've argued that one of the limitations on this approach that you're suggesting would be the awareness of the trial judge, of the circuit judge, at the time of sentencing in regard to changes that were coming. Am I stating that correctly?
Yes.
How would that work out practically?
Mm-hmm.
What do you see happening in that regard? What if it isn't the same judge?
Right. If it isn't the same judge, then I think the judge handling the matter is left with what appears on the record. But I do think it's consistent with how new factor jurisprudence works now, that in assessing whether something is new, whether it was unknowingly overlooked by the parties, there's an initial determination on the face of the record, because if the court had specifically said, I'm aware of the lesser penalty, that's taken care of. But there will be instances where nothing appears in the record, and I believe a judge could say in a decision denying a motion for modification that I was fully aware of the penalty change and therefore it's not a new factor.
For a lot of judges that would be a difficult thing to pinpoint time-wise? I mean, I'm just thinking about, okay, I know somewhere in 2002 I learned that these changes were coming, but I don't know if that was in January or that was in September. I'm wondering practically, how do you handle that?
Well, I think that's a possibility, but you know what? I don't think it matters too much, because the final question on the new factor test is, does the judge sitting there at the time the motion is brought believe that a modification is warranted? So if a judge can't recall, I don't know if I took it into account, the judge could issue a ruling that is, this may or may not be a new factor, I don't recall. Even if it was a new factor, I would not change the sentence for these reasons. And that's it.
Ms. Agopian, if I could, maybe part of the problem that I'm having with the argument is trying to link the statute with new factor jurisprudence. As I understand new factor jurisprudence, you didn't look at things like rehabilitation, things that happened at the institution. You look at the statute, 973-195, sub 1R, paragraph B, 1. The inmate's conduct, efforts at and progress in rehabilitation or participation in progress in education, treatment, or other correctional programs since he or she was sentenced is a ground for applying the sentence adjustment statute. And I guess where I'm having the problem is I see two separate things going on here. You've got the statute, which deals with the fact that the legislature got rid of the parole board, and it gives the the legislature has given the court some authority to do some correcting of sentences, where you've got the new factor jurisprudence that specifically says we don't look at those issues. We look at the Rosado definition. So, and I understand your arguments that they may overlap, but I don't see them as being the same thing.
Well, I don't really think they are the same thing. And as you indicated, the legislature in the statute giving the court the authority. Well, the court has the authority to exist already, okay? What the legislature is doing, I think, is expressing its intent that it wants the sentence modified under these various circumstances. So to that degree, it's fostering the court's exercise of its power to modify. This statute, though, does not in any way prohibit the court from going beyond that, from doing something completely different when it feels that justice requires it. And essentially, that's what I'm asking the court to do, to make really a policy decision that justice requires that this disparity be dealt with not only under the sentence adjustment statute as a potential avenue, but also as a new factor, so we have more likelihood of the same judge, so we can reach more people before they serve past the new maximum, so we can further the goals of rehabilitation and protection of the public, because the reality is that if that sentence cannot be touched until the 75-85% has been served, that delay is going to affect the inmate's ability to get into treatment, into programming, into a less secure institution. It really works the same effect as a detainer. And we've had, for years, have recognized that it's in not only the inmate's interest, but the public's interest to have the detainer resolved early. I would say it's not only in the inmate's interest, but in the public's interest to have the disparity addressed early as well.
Now, I have one additional question, and it deals with your argument earlier that the only thing the court would have to do is overrule Torres. And I raised the question of Hegwood and its interpretation of 990.04. You've asked us not to go down that path. So don't we have to withdraw some of the language in Hegwood if we adopt your position?
Personally, I would support the court in withdrawing some language, specifically the language that talks about how if the statute isn't retroactive, it can't be highly relevant, and instead look at it in terms of the penalty is always highly relevant, and so that
we can't get to your argument unless we do that.
No, I think you can, though, because this is the unique situation where it's not the ordinary penalty change. It's not the legislature sort of speaking for the public and saying, well, we've reassessed the severity of this offense, and therefore we're giving it a different penalty. This is a penalty that really wasn't intended to go into effect without the supplementation. We have in the history both houses quickly approving the lower penalties, and just through gridlock it didn't get done. I really think it's that very unique situation that would allow the court to write a decision that distinguishes, does not overrule Hegwood.
Could I ask, are there any sentences imposed before TIS 1 that authorize longer incarceration than under TIS 2?
That where the penalty actually went up under TIS 2? Yes, there are some. Mm-hmm.
Would your new factor jurisprudence apply to sentences imposed before January 31st, 1999?
No. It applies to sentences for offenses committed on or after December 31, 1999 until the end of TIS 1, which was February 1, 2003. It's a finite group, and frankly, their number is decreasing every day as more and more of them get through the system and out.
The advent of TIS 2 is such a watershed reduction of penalties. Why, at least in theory, wouldn't your new factor jurisprudence apply to pre-TIS 1 sentences if they're longer?
that apply to pre-TIS 1 sentences, meaning the indeterminate sentences, that if those are longer, then because the linkage isn't there. It's really our whole argument is premised on this linkage of the heightened penalties that came in TIS 1 that weren't intended to go into effect without supplementation and did through inadvertence. It's the linkage between the TIS 1 and the TIS 2 that's critical. Thank you.
Well, I have a question for you that you can think about while you're sitting down, Agropian. And that is, you appear to me to be asking for a really very modest kind of approach that covers your client. I sort of expected the public defender's office to argue that TIS 1 and TIS 2 have so changed the way sentences are done in this state that the whole concept of the circuit court's inherent power to change, to modify a sentence, really has been disconnected from Rosado, Champion, Michaels, that whole set of cases. In that the court intimated as much in, was it Champion or Crozier, where it said, hey, all bets are off with a new sentence structure. But you're not arguing that. You're really arguing for a very tiny kind of view of sentence modification that fits a small category. I say small because it's not so small. The category of defendants.
Would you like me to answer that?
I do.
Or hold it? Okay. We are arguing for what I think is a narrow holding, and we reached the decision to do that really in light of what the court decided in Crozier, where it affirmed the new factor jurisprudence for the TIS 1 sentences, leaving open the possibility of something, I think, like what we have in this case. I took Crozier really as a signal that the court was not going to be making any sort of sweeping changes in the new factor law, and that's why I've tried to present an argument here for a holding that works within that existing framework.
Thank you, counsel. Assistant Attorney General, arguing for the state of Wisconsin. Counsel?
Thank you. Good morning. I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state of Wisconsin as respondent, and this is the first of three truth in sentencing cases today. For alternative reasons, the state asks this court to reject the new factor argument of Mr. Trujillo. And the first of those is the state would ask this court to hold a TIS, and this is the precedent part of this, I think, of this case, in this first holding, and that is a TIS 2 reduction in maximum penalties for a particular crime does not satisfy the definition of new factor for sentence modification for a TIS 1 offender sentenced for that crime.
Counsel, isn't that a broader statement of the issue than has been argued earlier? Because this particular person not only had a reduction in the sentence, but the sentence that was imposed was greater than could have been imposed. So what you're saying to us is a broader argument than I've heard from opposing counsel so far. Maybe the next case, but that's not the case that's before us.
I'm suggesting that although the public defender would limit it to situations where the defendant has received a confinement term, a TSI-1 defendant, received a confinement term that exceeded the maximum that could have been imposed for that crime in TSI 2.
Right.
She's limiting it to that situation and to the situation where the court didn't speak to TIS 2 at sentencing. I'm suggesting that it probably can't be, if TSI 2's reduced penalties is highly relevant to sentencing, I don't see that it can really be limited so narrowly only to that specific situation. It seems to me it would apply across the board to everybody in TIS-1.
Okay, so you're saying that even though the argument is narrow today, the analysis that supports it has to support a broader result.
I believe so. I think you can conceive of situations where a TSI-1 offender, for example, who got less than the maximum for TSI-2 could say, well, the court was saying I want to put it in the middle range or whatever it might be. So I don't think you can limit it quite so narrowly. So that's the first precedent part. That
thank you.
This doesn't satisfy the definition of new factor. The second part
under Rosado and et cetera, under all of our old case law pre-TIS.
Right. Under both parts, the new factor, which is the first step of the two-step part of the two-step test, the definition of new factor actually has two components. One is that it's got to be new. The other is that it's got to be highly relevant to sentencing. And I'm suggesting this primarily goes to the highly relevant aspect, but it could also impact on the newness aspect of it. And this, I think a principal component of that, I'll get to that in a second, is legislative intent. In other words, the legislative intent here is that the TSI-1 penalties are the penalties that are supposed to be applied, are the only relevant penalties to the TSI-1 offenders. The second step, and I'll just preview this, the second step is the more case-specific step of the new factor test, and that is if there is a new factor, whether or not the trial court would choose to modify the defendant's sentence. And I would suggest that a fair reading of the record in this case, of the post-conviction or sentence modification motion hearing on this, was that the trial court, clearly aware of this situation, said, no, even if the maximum that I had available for confinement was 7.5 years of the TIS-2 maximum, that's not what I would have. I mean, I want to do it. 8 is what I wanted, regardless.
That goes to whether, should you not prevail on the law, there should be a remand.
Right. That goes specifically to this case.
That's right. It goes to the exercise. Did the trial court exercise its discretion under new factors? And you're saying it did, and it said no.
Yeah,
and there's a dispute between you and
there's me. There's a dispute on how you read that record. I suggest the fairest way is to read it that way. With respect, then, to the first proposition, the proposition that I think is the critical one here, the precedent-setting one, the meaning of highly relevant. The focus of the public defender here is on legislative intent, and I would suggest that legislative intent is different than what the public defender is suggesting it is in this situation. Read together, TIS-1 and TIS-2 reflect the legislative intent to have TSI-1 offenders sentenced solely in accordance with TIS-1 penalties. In TIS-1, the legislature decided to increase maximum possible sentences, penalties, by at least 50%, so that the maximum confinement term would match what used to be the total indeterminate sentence that was available. They did the same thing for unclassifieds, again, by 50% or 1 year, whichever was greater. I think most significantly, even when the legislature enacted TSI 2 in July 2002.
Well, before you move on to this 2, there was a reason why they increased the penalties, is that correct?
I presume so.
Wasn't the reason to try to get the period of initial confinement to be approximately the same as what it was under the old indeterminate sentencing?
Probably was the intent. I believe that's right.
You wouldn't argue that the intent of the legislature as part of TIS, whether we're talking TIS-1 or TIS-2, was to increase penalties.
Well, I think, and this is where I was just about headed, and that is that if the legislature really wanted the ultimate penalties that it enacted in TIS-2 to be what it wanted all along, it could very simply have said, when it enacted TIS-2, that the TIS-2 maximums apply to TSI-1 offenders, and it didn't do it. If it really wanted to do that. The other, if it really wanted to not have the TIS-1 penalties be the final word on this, it didn't have to enact TIS-1.
Didn't they create a criminal penalty study committee that was supposed to implement the rest of TIS before the effective day of TIS-1?
I think there was some anticipation. There certainly was a study committee that was ordered as part of TIS. The criminal penalty study committee was ordered as part of TIS-1. There was no directive, although they were directed to look at reclassifying crimes. There was no directive that said that they had to come up with a conclusion that the penalties that were in place under TIS-1 had to be reduced. In fact, another indication of legislative intent here is that the committee report came out in August 1999, which was 4 months before any TIS-1 offense could have been committed. TIS-1 applied to offenses beginning December 31st, 1999. So if the legislature, which ultimately enacted TIS-2, I mean, they were aware 4 months in advance that this was what was being recommended. But TIS-1 went into effect with those higher penalties. And this is what Hagman is premised on. And the cases that followed Torres is specifically related to this issue. And then there's Longmire that deals with the same question with respect to extended supervision terms. And that is that the legislative intent is reflected in the fact that the legislature chose not to make the penalties of TIS-2 retroactive to TIS-1 offenders. I think that's the clearest expression of legislative intent that you could find.
Why doesn't that work both ways? You're arguing that there's not a provision that says this includes TIS-1 offenders, and I grant you that. But nor is there a provision that says this applies only to TIS-2.
I think it's implicit from the fact that they didn't do it. Nobody's disputing that the penalties that were available to the court in this case and for TIS-1 offenders are the penalties that were in place at that time.
And the effective date is after TIS-1 ends.
The effective date of this
new sentencing modification law applies to the same date that TIS-2 comes into effect.
Right. TIS-2 penalties apply to offenses committed after February 1st, 2003. Right.
And it deals with offenses committed, not sentences before.
But I think there's a provision that applies both to the penalties and to the offenses. There's a specific section, if I'm understanding correctly what you're asking, there's a provision at the end of TIS-2 legislation that says the penalties apply after to offenses committed after that date.
Okay. If the offense was committed before February 1, but there wasn't a trial and there wasn't a sentencing until after February 1, the penalty in TIS-1 is applied.
That's correct. That's correct. That's right. Sorry if I confused that. I didn't mean to. An example here, I think a prime example that this court dealt with just recently, is Crozier. Crozier was the new factor case that talked about rehabilitation of the offender as a basis for a new factor. In Crozier, this court concluded that the legislative intent of truth in sentencing, that is, that the sentence imposed at the time of sentencing, that sentence, was the critical point in the sentencing process, so that categorically, regardless whether a particular defendant made rehabilitative efforts thereafter, that was not going to be a new factor. And that's predicated on the legislative intent, the view of the legislative intent. That's even clearer in this situation. The legislative intent here is even that much clearer than with respect to rehabilitation. And that's because you don't have the legislature saying retroactively, we're going to now say that these TIS-2 penalties apply to TSI-1 people. So I don't see a way of distinguishing this case from Crozier, quite frankly.
Well, that goes to my question, because once again, and I asked Ms. Hagopian about this, the basis for the Hagwood line of cases was an interpretation of 990.04. And basically what the court said was, look, the legislature has made a determination that you don't go back for sentence modifications just because you changed the penalties. The difference in this setting is the legislature clearly was intending to revise, reclassify, and reset the structure for criminal sentencing in the state of Wisconsin. It was supposed to, by legislative design, happen as one package.
And for reasons having nothing to do with the parties or this court, it didn't happen that way. So, and I think it's clear, I think that the literature makes it clear that there really was no intent to increase sentences. The intent was to revise the structure of criminal penalties. So TIS 1 is in that range in the middle where it didn't have the benefit of the finished product. And I think the argument, at least that I'm hearing Ms. Hagopian make, is that that distinguishes this case from the line of cases in Hagwood, where you've got a clear legislative mandate that there's no reason to go back because the legislature didn't intend anything different. That's how I see the difference between the two.
I understand the argument, and it's certainly, given the way Truth in Sentencing came down, it's certainly a interpretation of what the legislature intended. But it seems to me that the best evidence of what the legislature intended is what it actually did. I mean, it could have, if that's what the legislature really intended in TIS ultimately, then in TSI 2 it could very simply have said, we're going to make those TSI 1 penalties apply. I mean, those TIS 2 maximums, reduced maximums, apply to TSI 1 people, and it didn't. And what it did do, not only in this change in law situation, but with respect to rehabilitation as well, is it went ahead and enacted a sentence adjustment statute. Now, in the second argument today, we'll get into some of the nuts and bolts of that, and I don't want to jump the gun on that, but if that was the legislature's way of dealing with the change in the law, then it seems to me that's the new factor, because that deals with both, like I said, rehabilitation and change in law. That's what the legislative, if anything, is what the legislature intended to deal with the disparity in the maximum sentences.
You would agree that the legislative change is different than the new factor analysis?
Sure, it's a different process, and that there's limitations placed on it. But my suggestion is that statute would be meaningless if this court were to say that new factor analysis applies to change in law. Moreover, a defendant couldn't bring a new factor motion based on change in law and then go back later and bring a sentence adjustment claim based on that same exact change in law. That would be, I mean, we don't countenance that procedurally. That would be a procedural default. You can't have a second kick at the cat just because that statute's there. And I think
are you finished with that?
Go ahead.
Is the new state statute exclusive on modification?
I'm sorry?
Is the new statute exclusive as to how to modify?
I think so. I think so.
Takes over the inherent power of the trial court?
I think with respect to the categories that are listed in it, otherwise, if you had a new factor based on one of those categories in there, if you allowed for a new factor, it would render that moot. There would be no reason to have to wait that long to bring that kind of a claim.
Well, but the statute might then render moot the trial court's inherent power. How can that be?
Sure. And I guess if I could retract a little bit there, I think there could be situations where something happens before the 75-85% point is reached in a sentence. Some rehabilitation effort is made or something is made. And then something new happens later on. I mean, I don't think that new by definition means that it was something that wasn't going to be available for the court to look at.
But it can't be a reduction of the gravity of the offense.
It could be the very same change in the law, because why should you have a second kick saying that the TSI 2 penalties, we're first going to bring this now as a new factor, now you're saying it's not, then later on we're going to bring it as a sentence adjustment motion, the very same change. It seems to me that shouldn't be allowable.
But anything that's covered in that statute, in your view, is excluded from new factor under the court's inherent power?
Well, I think the subject matter is not entirely excluded. I guess maybe that's...
I accept the court has inherent power, and it remains inherent after this statute is enacted. But any issue covered by the statute, like rehabilitation, like the gravity of the offense, that's exclusively now by the statute.
Yes,
that's what I hear you say.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's a fair... I'm sorry.
How does that work with first offense, first degree sexual assault, class B felony?
Class B felonies are not covered under the statute.
Right.
And let's say that there's a motion with regard to Class B felony because the change in the law with regard to the gravity of offense.
Right.
Under your argument, is there any relief possible under either inherent authority or the statute in question?
It would be excluded by the sentence adjustment statute.
Okay.
It could be, right. That's one exception that this superfluous argument wouldn't cover.
Doesn't your argument also indicate your inherent authority argument with new factor analysis that it would not be available, any relief would not be available under inherent authority either under your argument?
Because it's not covered by the sentence, with all due respect, because it's not covered by the sentence adjustment statute, I think it's fair to say that there could be a new factor argument based on that. But
what's the that? My that was change in the law with regard to gravity of offense. That's my that. Okay. Can you answer it with regard to my question? Is there inherent authority under new factor analysis for the court to change when reduce the sentence when the argument of new factor is based on a change in the law vis-a-vis gravity of offense? Is there inherent authority to do that under your new factor analysis?
I'm not suggesting that there isn't, that the new factor analysis remains the same. I'm just suggesting that in the circumstance that we're dealing with here, where you have a TIS-2 reduced maximum that would be covered under the sentence adjustment statute, for example, or even more broadly, any kind of TIS-2 reduced maximum itself should not be considered a new factor. For people in TIS-1, whether it's a Class B felon or any other TSI offender, I think the remedy here for sentence modification is going to be unduly harsh. And I would suggest also that in light of Galleon, if trial courts here are following Galleon as they are expected to and imposing the minimum amount of custody and following all the criteria of that and articulating those on the record, that there shouldn't theoretically be a problem with a sentence that's imposed for a TSI-1 offender. And if the TSI-1 offender feels that the sentence is unjust, because now the legislature has said in TIS-2 that the maximums aren't going to be quite so grave, he or she could bring an unduly harsh claim.
Okay. So I think since you're emphasizing there could be an unduly harsh claim, the answer to my question is no. My question was, for Class B felonies, on a new factor, in a situation where there is a change in the law which changes the gravity of the offense, is there relief under the statute? Is there any relief possible, either under the statute or the new factor analysis in inherent power? And I think your answer is no.
Right, based on the new factor as the statute.
So you've then segued into, you didn't want to, since you find no inherent authority for new factor, your answer is there could still be inherent authority to modify the sentence if it is excessive. Right?
Right.
Court has authority to change the law on new factors?
Sure.
And the court would have the authority to say that the new factor and doctrines were grounded in an indeterminate sentence. I mean, it traces back to Rosado. I didn't go back beyond Rosado as to the new factors. And that the new factors whole jurisprudence might be changed in light of the fact that it's not indeterminate, in light of the fact there's no parole board, in light of the fact the only change that can be made is by the trial court.
I'm not sure I fully understand. Are you suggesting that the new factor test itself be reformulated in light of USIT?
Yeah, and I mean, it was developed when there was a parole board that could look at rehabilitation. It was developed when there was a parole board that could say, the guy's terminally ill, send him to a hospice, we don't have to keep him in Waupun, right? Court didn't have to do that. So the court said, that's not a new factor for the court to consider. He's under the jurisdiction of somebody else in this state. Those are factors that, under the law, that entity was to consider, right?
Sure.
Now, we don't have this other entity, right?
That's correct.
So the whole area of development of what is a new factor for the court to consider, you can view it as needn't, but you can view it as not quite fitting anymore because you don't have that parole board. So rehabilitation, which the court didn't have to look at because you could rely on the parole board, when you look at an institutional analysis of who has better knowledge, right? The court or the parole board? You'd say the parole board. I would say that. I think the court said that. Now, without a parole board, you say, who has better institutional knowledge about whether there should be a modification? And you only have one answer, the court, because there is no other answer.
Sure. Well, you're getting exactly at what the legislature was dealing with, I think, when they were determining what to do about truth in sentencing. And I think what happened ultimately in TIS-2 is that the legislature did, at least as a compromise, come to some kind of determination that there's got to be some safety valves, if you will, something to address the fact that there may be situations arising after sentencing.
By statute, which did not exclusively take over from the court's inherent power.
Absolutely, but I also think that when you're looking at this specific area that we're talking about here, the TIS-2 reduced maximums, the legislative intent is an important consideration in what the court does or doesn't do. And again, I would reiterate Crozier is a perfect example of one of those types of things, rehabilitation, where the court has said just recently that categorically we're not going to have that be considered a new factor. And I think here you've got legislative intent, where, I'm repeating myself here, but that the legislature in TIS-2 decided not to make the TSI-2 reduced maximums available to TIS-1 offenders.
Mr. Freimuth, we're obviously dealing here with disparate sentences during a 3-plus-year period that are troubling to some people. And if you prevail, a number of avenues of redressing that will be closed off. Is there a legislative effort being headed up by the Department of Justice or anyone else to ameliorate these disparate sentences?
Not that I'm aware of, but I don't have my hand on the pulse of what's legislatively out there. I'm not aware of anything. I don't know if the public defender is.
Did you read the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel series?
I was aware of it, and I glanced at it, but I have to admit that I did not have time to read through it. The gist of it is this concern. I understand the concern that there are people out there who have sentences that may exceed the TSI-2 maximum term of confinement. But again, I would submit that there are avenues to deal with that, and that if the legislature really wanted those people to be subject to the TIS-2 penalties, it could have done so. I also would suggest, again, in reference to Galleon, if the sentencing court, and maybe where, I mean, there's an assumption here that if this new factor is applied and we go back to the trial court, that the trial judge is going to, in fact, reduce the confinement term. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. And I know the defense, the public defender isn't arguing that that's automatic, but if the trial court in the first instance is doing what it's supposed to do, then we shouldn't be having problems.
Counsel, you rely on Crozier from last term, but as I look at the last paragraph of Crozier, the court said unanimously, additionally, we continue to employ existing new factor jurisprudence for TIS-1 sentences, comma, while noting there may be additional new factors unique to TIS 1 that we have not previously identified, period. Now, I would read that if it weren't written by this court. I would read it from any court as a court giving themselves a wiggle room.
Sure.
Crozier dealt with a modification dealing, a motion for modification dealing on some, on the basis of rehabilitation. And we said rehabilitation is not a new factor under our existing jurisprudence. And,
that's correct.
Right, that's right. Have we, does Crozier, because I have not closely reread it, I just pulled it out and looked at the holding in some other language. Is there anything in the analysis in Crozier that would keep this court from saying a new factor is a change in the law addressing the gravity of the offense?
Not specifically, since it didn't deal with it. But again, by analogy, I would say this situation is even clearer when you're looking at, to the extent that Crozier is based on legislative intent, and legislative intent being truth in sentencing means you get the sentence that's imposed at the time of sentencing.
Mr. Feinmuth, if I could, I want to address the newness portion of your argument. You really haven't had time to argue it here, but I'm looking at page 10 of your brief, and you highlight some language and italicize some language where you say a set of facts highly relevant to the imposition of the sentence, and then you jump down to, even though it was in existence, it was unknowingly overlooked by the parties, and you focused on that aspect. I thought the whole point of this argument was that TIS 2 wasn't in existence, so the unknowingly overlooked is not relevant. Am I missing something?
Now, this is the newness part of my argument is an alternative argument, and it's based on the notion that this was out there, and judges and the bar were being trained on this even before TIS 1 offenses could take effect. So I'm suggesting that even though in a particular case maybe the trial court judge didn't refer to TIS 2, I think it's a fair bet to say that most courts would have been aware of it anyway.
No, but they're aware of it. But the point is you only get to the awareness factor if it's something that's already in existence. And I think the whole point of Rosado was this TIS 2 wasn't yet in existence, so you don't get to the unknowingly overlooked. That's the part where that's what confused me about that.
Okay.
Counselor, I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish your answer to him.
That's fine.
Are you done? You know, if going back to the very first question I asked you about the breadth of the rule that you thought we were talking about here, you know, if I were to buy the argument that some relief should be provided to those who received a longer sentence under TIS 1 than they could have under TIS 2, but the rationale would be that the court exercises its inherent power because that sentence is, to us now, unduly harsh, rather than a new factor, could the rule then be limited only to those who, in fact, did receive a longer sentence in TIS 1?
I think the argument that the defendant would make, to the extent the defendant is making that argument based on TIS 2, obviously that would be the thrust of that argument. In other words, the legislature has now said that this ultimate penalty shouldn't go above a certain point for confinement, and you know, maybe, court, you should look at that because you gave me more than what the legislature now says this crime, regardless of how serious it is. For a defendant who is sentenced to less than that, that argument isn't going to be as persuasive, obviously, because there hasn't been, and it hasn't exceeded the TIS 2 maximum.
Right.
But I think the rationale could be put forth saying that the defendant could say that, well, sentencing court, if you remember at sentencing, you said that you thought my offense was in the middle range or something of the available penalties, and now that middle range is a lower middle range, doesn't that mean that your sentence should get reduced?
But it certainly is a softer response than if we find that it is a highly relevant factor, then it's always a new factor, right? If I understand what you said to me the first go round, it was if you're going to define the change in the sentence as a new factor, then it is a factor that's highly relevant to sentencing, correct?
I mean, it has to satisfy that definition,
right? It does. And so
your argument for, or really opposing counsel's argument, for those folks that received less than the maximum, but for a crime where the maximum was reduced, is, if it's a new factor here, to me, I can understand your broad rule, the way you answered me first off. But as I'm thinking about it and thinking about the fairness argument that opposing counsel makes on behalf of a client who did receive more than the max, you can say that the sentence is unduly harsh without saying it's a new factor, correct? There's different analysis.
That's right.
What would the rationale be?
For unduly harsh? Well, it would sort of be the new factor. I mean, it would sort of be the change in law argument coupled with specific circumstances of the case. I mean, I guess you'd be unduly harsh or looking at it case by case and saying, you know.
So you'd have a hard time relying on the fact that the sentence went down by the legislature. You'd have to find something specific about this guy.
I think so. I mean, I think even regardless of.
Otherwise, you'd have to mask new factor into harsh and deal with it that way. The standard of review would be different, maybe. Question of law as to what's a new factor. Question of discretion as to harsh.
Right. But I think the bottom line, even if you got this in a new factor, and I know my time's up, if I could just finish this thought. Even if in a new factor analysis, you're still looking at the trial court has to make a decision. Does this really matter to me based on what I did the first time around?
Right. And the public defender agrees with that. This is not automatic.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Frymuth. You'll have another half hour in a different case.
Right.
All right. Ms. Hagopian.
Thank you. Let me pick up on this discussion of the unduly harsh angle. I don't think that works very well.
Okay.
And, in fact, I don't know that that would really be fair to the trial judges, because an unduly harsh analysis really is saying that the trial court erred in its exercise of discretion at sentencing, that the sentence it imposed shocks the conscience. I think, you know, the rule we're seeking here is really needed because of the conscientious judge who was trying to do a good job imposing sentence in TIS 1 and got such mixed signals and an incomplete system under which to work. So that when the state says that if judges were doing what they were supposed to do, we wouldn't have a problem, I strongly disagree with that. I think it's because the judges were trying under a very difficult system to get it right. Those same judges need to have an opportunity to look at the sentence again, at least in the limited circumstance where the confinement term exceeds the new maximum. And along those same lines, I think the judge needs to have that authority to do it now rather than later. So we have a better chance of having the same judge on the bench as the one who imposed sentence, so that the judge, when making a decision whether to modify the sentence, can consider, is this going to further the rehabilitation? And if so, I can address it now rather than when it's too late. And for those cases as well, for the individual has received so much time, the judge needs to be able to address it now so that he or she can actually rectify the problem instead of at 75 or 85% saying, gee, it's too bad, this is all I can do. You know, one point I disagree very strongly with the state, and I think we'll talk about this even more in the next case. The statute is not exclusive. It cannot be exclusive in the area of sentence modification. It's an inherent power placed in the judiciary. This court decides what is fair and just in the realm of sentence modification. As I said earlier, I believe legislative intent helps inform the court's decision, but it does not dictate a result.
One of the things that's been bothering me, and I just didn't check it out, is we had mandatory minimums, not too many, but some. And there are many states that have mandatory minimums, which does interfere with the court's discretion, inherent discretion in sentencing. Are there any cases that challenge these mandatory minimums as unconstitutional? There's something about this where a judge sentences somebody to 25 or 150 years, which is not unheard of, and no opportunity for change except under the statute of after you serve 75%, 85%. Anything out there which indicates that kind of thing is just unconstitutional?
I believe the law is pretty clear that the legislature has very broad power in setting the penalty, which includes the power to set a mandatory sentence, a mandatory minimum, and if the legislature does that, the court's discretion is taken away. The power to impose the sentence still remains in the hands of the court, but effectively the discretion has been removed.
I don't think Blakely affects this case, do you?
I was thinking about Blakely as well. I don't think it really does, although to see how it plays out, I guess, in thinking about the state's floodgates argument, that sometimes to do the right thing does require more work. And, you know, the federal courts certainly have been thrown into an upheaval, while perhaps the Supreme Court is thinking that maybe that's necessary to do the right thing. I think what we're proposing here does not throw the courts into an upheaval. We've tried to submit some numbers, which I think are sort of a sampling of what we might expect. It's a very small group that we're talking about. I think a small number of filings. These can be resolved in most instances without a hearing if the court's going to deny them. So I guess maybe I've gotten off on Blakely, but to the extent the court is concerned at all about floodgates, I guess I'd just ask the court to consider, first of all, that something even more important is at stake here, which is the administration of justice, and that we really aren't opening ourselves up for a flood, but what seem to be pretty manageable numbers in terms of the people that would be affected by what we're proposing.
Counselor, though, according to opposing counsel's argument, anybody that's sentenced under TIS 1 to a crime where the sentence was decreased in TIS 2, even though they got way less than the maximum, would be subject to the rule you're asking us to put out. Do you disagree with that?
Absolutely.
Why?
The holding we're asking is that it's a new factor only if the confinement term imposed under TIS 1 exceeds the confinement term for the same offense under TIS 2. And I know the state has argued, but it could be broader than that. It could be. That's not what we're asking for. And if the court says it's not broader than that, it's not broader than that.
If it's a new factor highly relevant to sentencing, which is what we would have to say in order to adopt your argument, how can we say then the increase in the sentence is, or the decrease in the sentence is not a new factor for the next person that comes before us?
Because it would not overrule Hegwood. And you would say we're distinguishing Hegwood for this unique situation here where it's not the ordinary penalty change, but where the penalty that was in effect for 3 years was really a poor indicator of the legislature's assessment of the gravity of the offense.
But you see, you're still focusing on the penalty. I mean, I understand your argument.
But it's the linkage between TIS 1 and 2 that's critical.
I know that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hagopian. Thank you, Mr. Frymuth. Ms. Hagopian, we're going to see more of you this afternoon, too. That concludes our argument on 03-1463-CR State versus Trujillo. We're going to take a few moments in recess so these students may leave and other students may enter, and then we'll get to State Left, which both of you are going to be arguing. And you also, you shall proceed. You get a respite.